This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning, and this is The Breakfast Grill. With the word Merdeka shouted seven times shortly after midnight on the 31st of August 1957, a new nation was created. In 63 years, Malaysia has achieved much, economically becoming a middle-income nation. But if we look at racial unity, how far have we come? Are we more united or divided? Questions we attempt to answer today with our panel. And joining us is Dato' Dr. Syad Salim Farooqi, Tunku Abdul Rahman Professor of Constitutional Law at University Malaya, and Edin Koo, author and frequent commentator on social, cultural issues, and of course also founder of Pusaka. Thank you for being here today, gentlemen. Now, race relations and, of course, unity, or maybe the lack of it in Malaysia, is a complicated issue to navigate since, I mean, we are a large melting pot of different ethnicities and cultures. But objectively, Dato, if we look back from 1957 to now, how far have we come in terms of racial unity?
There's no simple answer, as you yourself observed. This is an incredibly complex issue. Unity is a long-term process that requires constant strengthening and calibration. It is a journey, not a destination. And for Malaysia, what I can say is this, that there have been ups and downs. So what we need to do is to count our blessings as well as note our shortcomings and propose some solutions. There are currents and cross-currents. At the moment, certainly our relationships with Sabah Sarawak, our inter-religious, inter-communal relationships are strained. At the same time, as I said, there are currents and cross-currents. In 2018, Malays, Indians, Chinese, Sabah Sarawakians joined together to do something that is normally not achievable in many other Asian and African societies. And you know, the remarkable thing that happened in 2018 was that after the election results were announced, I know they were delayed, deliberately delayed, but after they were announced, there were no riots, no coup d'etat, no National Operations Council. We achieved a peaceful change of government. So that's a positive point. COVID-19, I don't think race or religion has been an issue. And may I also mention this to you, much depends on which part of the garden we are looking at. If you look at ordinary citizens, the policeman on a motorbike getting down to help, Malay policeman helping a Chinese lady cross Jalan Gasing. I've seen that with my own eyes. If you look at people in the office, in the schools, I was a lecturer at ITM and UITM for 45 years. The students were all Malays or Bumiputras. I got a lot of affection from them. Some of my colleagues, it's now 45 years actually, and we still stay in touch. So at the individual level, I think there are a lot of bridges of understanding. It is the politicians, some of them. It is the political parties that hide in the gutters of hatred, and they seek to divide, they seek to create insecurity in order to remain in power. So much depends on which part of the garden we are looking at. But all in all, I think our picture is mixed.
And Edin, do you share his view? Do you think things have improved or deteriorated, or it's not so simplistic as that?
No, I don't think it's simplistic at all. In fact, I think it's coloured with all kinds of paradoxes and contradictions. I think it is deteriorating at one aspect that is concentrating a lot of our attention. That is the various levels of power struggles that are going on in the political realm, in the state and national realm, in particular institutions. There are concurrent political struggles that are going on. And of course, in a political struggle, the most convenient and exploitative aspect is race and religion. So I think it's very concentrated there. I've done 30 years work in Pusaka on culture, and that involves a lot of going to the grassroots, really. I think relationships there are strong and very open.
Yes, people
are very open to each other. This is something that I think we need to build on. I think one of the main problems we have is a lack of knowledge, really, about each other. That doesn't help in breeding the necessary empathy we need. Not understanding and tolerance, real empathy that is needed. But I think we have those foundations already. Last year, I spent all of last year and a half being a chairman of one of the most contentious issues that has plagued this country for 40 years, vernacular schools, and looking at the United Examination Certificate thing. While there have been lots of it's quite a raucous debate that goes on.
Yes,
I think never seems to end.
Yeah, never seems to end. One of the very basic things and one of the foundations of the country, for example, citizenship, the right of someone to belong, that is not disputed by even sometimes the most extreme of forces. So I think in that sense, I've always believed that, you know, we were already a community before we became a nation.
Mm.
We became a nation because we had the foundations of a community already and a shared history. I think these things need to be delved into a far greater for us to be able to build the necessary empathy that I was talking about.
You know, I want to follow up on a point Edin made, which is about openness and that ability to have that dialogue. So, Dato, I want to ask you, you know, we always speak in hushed tones when it comes to anything regarding race. You know, some will even say, let's not bring it up. It was all very sensitive. Let's not talk about it. But how important is that spirit of openness that actually will bring about that unity as a nation? How can we go about this in a very mature manner?
Now, I think it's very important that we must have intercultural dialogue, interreligious dialogue. Many years ago, actually, there was an attempt by a social action group to ask for an interreligious council.
Yeah.
It was opposed by some people on flimsy grounds, but surely, it's very, very important because in my humble view, most prejudices are born out of ignorance. And once actually we could begin to see the issue from a slightly different perspective, we can realize that I was encapsulated. I was living under a coconut shell. Actually, the truth is much bigger and possibly much more beautiful.
But do you think then would a statutory and institutional framework, I mean, like some sort of law, so Racial Harmony Act, would that work in Malaysia? Do you think that's necessary?
There are several things that need to go in tandem, yeah. I fear sometimes that there's an overemphasis on creating statutory bodies to regulate all these things. I think they're absolutely necessary, but they have to be co-joined with other efforts that are more sublime, I think, or subliminal, really to go back and delve into our history and our cultural history in particular. That is incredibly important because that is the resource that reminds us that somehow we have a shared history, not political history so much, cultural history. I think this is not being done. We are a hugely polyglot society in essence, and I think we need to understand what that shared history is. My great fear, especially in the past 40 years, has been this rise of cultural Puritanisms, you know. Mm. And these things actually go against what our historical realities actually are. I think that needs to be emphasized. So education, but not education within a curriculum or within the schools alone, but actual debate, actual conversation, actual dialogue with a strong footing in our cultural history, I think is imperative.
And in this day and age where social media is the choice of many to communicate and discuss their views, does the immediacy of it actually fan the flames of racial disunity? Dato, what do you think?
Yeah, actually, you said something very important here. A lot of the strain that we are feeling today may not be new. Maybe these feelings are always there, but social media has given it wings. So the hate monger now has a medium that he didn't have earlier.
In almost instantaneous.
Instantly. I like to put it this way. I know it's not very nice. They basically defecate in outer space,
yeah.
On the internet and or on this. So a lot of the hatred that we hear about or we read about was probably always there as a pent-up feeling, but now it is given wings. A second factor is this, and I am trying to make it positive. It is actually the evolution of a democratic society. More people are now free to talk and prepared to talk. And sadly, they don't worry about the quality. They just say whatever comes to their mind. I want to go back to what Edin was saying. Law alone is not enough. Justice is not in legislation. Justice is in administration. But nevertheless, legal framework is necessary. The reason I agree with Ning about a Social Harmony Act is this, that at the moment, most of the laws we have, Sedition Act, Printing Presses Act, are negative. The effort is to punish. On the other hand, if there were a National Harmony Act, it could have different aims. The first aim would be to bring people together. So if I said something that is obnoxious, that is hurtful, I should be required to attend a session whereby I have to open my ears and my eyes and my heart to a different point of view. Second one would be educational. Maybe I should attend a course. Only if this fails, then there would be a penalty. And I want to say this to you, some countries like Singapore, UK are experimenting with this. Punishment is the last resort. The first aim is what you were saying, not necessarily in the curriculum, education otherwise.
Yeah,
Edin, what do you think about the fact that now everyone can just tweet out something instantaneously without, you know, any consequence any reflection? Actually.
I've always been on the other side of social media. I think it's a place for pirates. I also say, you know, it is one of, I think, the great problems we have today, and this is a very deep-seated one, yeah, is language. It's our ability to be eloquent, to have a firm grasp of language, to be able to conduct an argument rather than being reductive. And I'm also talking about a certain kind of activism that has emerged that is all about sloganeering. And, you know, if you look at the Black Lives Matter thing that exploded recently and compare it to the civil rights movement, I was amazed at how much good literature came out of the civil rights movement that is not coming out of the Black Lives Movement because people are stutterers these days. You know, they're tongue-tied and they operate only within 124-letter radius. You know,
really?
World. Yeah, that is extremely difficult. So the problem actually goes very, very, very deep. I think what social media reflects is what human obsessions are, and this is a very worrying thing. And a lot of people who engage in the most defecating way in cyberspace sometimes are also very educated people.
On the Breakfast Grill this morning is Datuk Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, Tunku Abdul Rahman Professor of Constitutional Law at University Malaya, and Edin Koo, author and frequent commentator on social cultural issues and, of course, founder of Pusaka. Up next, can we move away from identity politics? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to the Breakfast Grill, where this morning in the hot seats are Datuk Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, Tunku Abdul Rahman Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, and Edin Koo, author, frequent commentator on social cultural issues, and of course, founder of Pusaka. Just a moment ago, we asked if we have regressed as a nation when it comes to racial unity. Yes. And gentlemen, I'll move on to education, something we talked about earlier, because I think, you know, we can't deny that has a role in terms of our attitudes, our behaviours, our thought. So do you think the current state of Malaysian education in terms of just syllabus and also the system contributes to the state of racial unity that we face today? Let's start with you, Dato. What do you think?
Surely the education system is moving in the wrong direction. First of all, the curriculum is not adequate. Interfaith studies are not there. Intercultural studies are not there. There's emphasis more on a particular perspective of life. Actually, the reality is this, that our cultures are intermingled, are interdependent. And to me, that's very important. Most of us have a mixed heritage, but we are in denial. If we could recognize that the rivers of our life were watered from streams from many, many, many cultures and civilizations, then we could begin to see the other as a distant cousin.
a bit more empathy for each other.
Yes.
Something what Edin said earlier, right?
Yes, yes. So I think the education system in that respect has failed. School teachers, school principals, there's not much inclusiveness. Our education system certainly, the national education system has failed. If kids don't learn together, how will they live together?
Edin, as you said, someone who sits on the reform committee on vernacular schools, what can we do to repair this situation?
No, my arguments always get very protracted, and they get very large and very very philosophical. But I think we have arrived at that point when you look at the practical side of education and then you look on at the ideals. I think one of the problems we have is pedagogy. You know, why do we get educated? What are we going to schools for? So you know this thing about national schools being quite rotten in its quality and standard of education, and so Chinese schools are better. But, you know, there's the argument that Chinese schools, for example, teach their students in rote. And, you know, you are essentially producing automatons sometimes that then the national school wants to emulate. It's about how many distinctions you get. And I interviewed some people, you know, who are like gotten 18 distinctions and 19 distinctions, and they can't carry on a conversation because they struggle with things like language, with expansive thought. So I think we really need a review of just about all the contours about education, but it's essential. But we need to have a debate and a dialogue that goes beyond what is contained in our syllabus and the accuracy of information. I mean, can you imagine if you're having a debate about the accuracy of information, how bad things must be?
I'm very happy with what Edin said about education is not simply about getting A's in so many subjects. I think education should be about preparation for life. It should be about activity of thought, receptivity to beauty and to humane feeling. If education doesn't teach us how to live together, I think it has failed.
Yeah.
Or even think together as a nation, right?
Yes.
That's something very lacking. Yeah. I also wonder, as a nation, right, how can we escape from this very obvious identity politics that we have in this country, which in a way makes the concept of racial unity harder to attain, I think. What do you think, Dato?
It'll be a slow process. I think a fair number of young people today, at least from my experience, are beginning to think differently. But when they will make an impact, I'm not so sure. Also, may I point out that as long as there is political instability, no clear majority, I think the gutter politicians will continue to seek appeal to race and to religion. But I think if there was to be stability in terms of numbers, I would be hopeful that someone would get up and say, this is not right, we have to do things differently. Sometimes a person of a very privileged background can show a lot of compassion for the less privileged. In Pakistan, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was actually the son of a great landlord, but he was so conscious of the position of the poor. Many, many changes actually in that President Roosevelt brought in the USA were not in any way connected with his background. there was a Chief Justice Earl Warren. He was a very safe, center, right of center Republican. But then when he became a judge, something happened. He started favoring human rights. He's the one who, in Brown versus Board of Education, said, desegregate with all necessary haste. So I think people can change, but there needs to be some political stability. I'm a little bit worried that if things remain as they are, as what Edin was mentioning, then politics will remain dominant. But if things were to stabilize politically, I'm just praying whoever comes to power, whoever, I hope they have a workable majority so that they can attend to the affairs of the nation rather than simply work for their own survival.
But this nature of coalition politics is here to stay, I think, for Malaysia and for a lot of countries out there, right? So does that mean then we will only have this kind of conversation if we had a majority government? What do you think, Andy?
Well, a majority government can sometimes... I differ slightly with Prof. Okay. In the sense that the majority government or a stable government may want very inimical things for our society. And it looks that way sometimes when you look at our political demographic. I think one of the good things one of the positive things about Malaysia is that we are an extremely difficult country, demographically. So as you can see, you know, now there's Bersatu who is having to open its...
Multiracial party, wanting to open its
doors up to becoming a multiracial party. I think at some level... there is a consciousness of that in all political parties, that somehow we need to evolve as a multiracial entity because our demographic is that difficult. Politics can sometimes be very paradoxical. And since we're using American references, I think one of the most progressive presidents contained with him all the contradictions was Lyndon Johnson. Mm. I mean, here was a hooligan politician who literally wrested his way and wrestled his way from the deep south all the way up, you know, who presented the Great Society and then got mired in Vietnam. Yeah. So, you know, it really depends on what the mission is for sometimes a political individual himself. So I think political will is very important if there is political will. Yeah. But I find that many politicians are now captive to what I call very fractious and gutter politics that does not actually necessarily represent what the majority is thinking.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually, that leadership will make a difference. I think Jesse Jackson said that leaders of substance do not follow opinion polls. Yeah. They mold opinion, not with guns or dollars or position, but with the power of their souls. So I would agree with you, actually, that a leader can make a difference, no matter where he comes from. Yeah. At the moment, we just hope and pray for the best.
On The Breakfast Grill this morning, we have Datuk Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, Tunku Abdul Rahman, Professor of Constitutional Law at University Malaya, and Edin Koo, author and frequent commentator on social cultural issues and, of course, founder of Pusaka. We'll be back after the 8:30 a.m. news bulletin in this extended interview where we'll discuss the role individuals can play in fostering racial unity. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to this extended Breakfast Grill with Datuk Dr. Shad Salim Farooqi, Tunku Abdul Rahman, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, and Edin Koo, author, frequent commentator on social, cultural issues, and of course, founder of Pusaka. I'm Wong Xiaoning. And gentlemen, I want to move on to instruments of racial unity and on, you know, some of which we have already touched upon. But the first one, of course, is this, our constitution. And I want to re-examine it a little bit more. I think so much of it has been forgotten in terms of, like you say, it's a living document, right? It keeps on evolving. Why is there a reluctance almost for us to look back at it? Datuk, what do you think? This is, you know, as in like we seem to be making very grandiose statements like shared prosperity.
By culture, by history, we are basically an authoritarian society. We are a feudal society. And the whole idea of a constitution is the opposite of all this. Mm. Constitution means that those in power have limits. It means that ordinary people, rich or poor, have rights which are enforceable against those in power. No matter how high and mighty you might be, the law is still above you. So I think those in power anywhere in the world do not wish the citizens to know too much about their rights. So I think that's one factor. Secondly, because of the influence, and I would say negative influence, of the British legal system. In Britain, there is no written constitution. So Parliament is supreme. Here, too, that's the impression. Parliament can do what it likes. Would you believe that in this country, a person can become a judge without having studied the Malaysian constitution for a single day? Because the entry qualification to the bar is such that there is no requirement that you have studied Malaysian law. You can be from the Inns of Court, a great prestigious qualification. Yeah. But Inns of Court means you have not studied the Malaysian constitution for a single day. So I think the constitution is not something that those in power favor. The constitution is not something that many of the judges are familiar with. Certainly magistrates, Sessions Court president, they are not familiar with. Civil servants are not familiar. The police are not familiar. I've taught at the Maktab Police Charas, and when I talk to them about fundamental rights, they say, sir, you don't understand, when we arrest someone and question him, we are not dealing with some gentleman. We are dealing with hardcore criminals. So we have to use some rough tactics. I say, yeah, but the issue is this. The Constitution says he has a right to see a lawyer. He has a right to know the grounds of arrest. He has a right to be produced before a magistrate. So I think we are a society that is not really wedded to the idea of rule of law or constitutionalism. But I'm not pessimistic. We are 63 years old. Look at how long it took in the USA, for example, to give freedom to the slaves.
So, Edin, do you have anything to add on this?
I mean, you know, Prof encapsulates it brilliantly. I, for a very long time, was very angry at our constitution because I used to believe that it was a constitution of convenience, you know, that essentially the British wanted to flee, and so they just drew this thing up. But after reading Professor's articles and his writings, I realized that how much of a living document it is, that it needs to breathe, it constantly needs to be negotiated, constantly needs to be talked about, all these various boundaries. But we don't have that literacy.
And Edin, I move on to another instrument because your late father, Professor Tan Sri Kukit Lim, helped draft the Rukun Negara in 1969 after the racial riot. So I probably don't need to remind you, but the first ambition of our country is, you know, mencapai perpaduan yang lebih erat dalam kalangan seluruh masyarakatnya, or in English, achieving more perfect unity amongst the whole of our society. Do you think this declaration of national philosophy, which I think is a very good way to foster unity among races, has not been used enough or even effectively in this day and age?
Well, you know, after a while, I think the national principles were meant to develop a more philosophical society, a society rooted in argument, actually. But if you look at the way the Rukun Negara has been presented and inculcated, it's very Soviet style. It's become a kind of pledge that you recite. That wasn't meant to be it. You know, these were foundations upon which we were supposed to inspire a society that could philosophize. And it's not just about then, you know, hukum, you know, about what you should not, what is prohibited, what is permissible, what is not permissible. It's about to have a debate about values and so on. So, and that is not sustained. So we have the national principles, and right from the beginning, there was no effort really to put a lot of intellectual and philosophical content. It did become a kind of Soviet style pledge that you recited every day, every Monday in school, and then you had this, you know, organized community activities like Rukun Tetangga to bring communities together. For me, all these things, I suppose, they are reflections of a nation and its challenges. But for me, again, we arrive at a point where it will inevitably become like this, a Soviet-style kind of raise your right hand and pledge. And then we even start to distort its spelling and we don't understand it's a compound noun. It all becomes quite silly, if you ask me. For me, as long as our real strengths, the real foundations of our nationhood, which is our shared cultural history, are not explored, then all of these things will eventually inevitably become what they become, elements of the state that you pledge allegiance to.
And finally, gentlemen, I want to talk about our roles, our individual roles in fostering racial unity. I mean, it's easy to say it's the government's job, it's education, all the other institutions. But we too, as Malaysians, are accountable. So let me start with you, Dato. What can we do on an individual basis to foster racial unity?
Yeah, I think that's where things should begin. In fact, in our home, to our kids, in our school, in our classroom, in our clubs, in our neighborhood, that's where actually unity should begin. We cannot rely entirely on the government. In fact, we should not rely on the government at all. We must all develop multiple identities, by which I mean, besides being a male or a Muslim, I'm also a law person. I'm also a member of a neighborhood, member of a club. I have hobbies. I have other interests. So multiple identities. If I develop multiple identities, I would then be actually mixing with people from many, many different backgrounds. And that sole identification with race or religion will diminish. Secondly, I think we raised that earlier. I think we should not be in denial about our mixed heritage, that actually this country consists of people whose lives actually are enriched by the values and the traditions of many, many cultures and civilizations. We should not confuse faith and faithful. Sometimes we come across a person, let us say, who is dishonest. And we say, ah, he belongs to this religion or this race. No, this is stereotyping. Mm. There's a difference between the faith and the faithful. We should distinguish between racism and racial consciousness. It's all right to be conscious of your race or of your gender or of your profession or even the race of someone else, ethnicity of someone else. I may want to work for the Orang Asli, but that's not racism. Racism is hatred for others, trying to keep them down. So there's no need to put anyone down. There are two ways of rising in life. One is through our effort, we fly as high as our wings take us. The other one is to try to bring the other down. So I think many of these things can be done, but surely the beginning must come in the home. The way we bring up our kids, stereotype language, stereotype prejudices, I think that's where, that's what we should desist.
And Edin, what would you like to add to this? I mean, as an individual.
I was brought up in a very multiracial home. There are challenges. My father's Chinese, my mother's Indian. I was raised by a Malay woman who lived with us. Her family lived with us. I was raised by her. So my immediate entry into this nation was in all its complexity and all in how difficult it was. And there were no set rules or, you know, things were not purposefully done for, you know, my parents' children to be aware of how complicated our society was. It just was the way it was. It was organic. But I was highly traumatized as a young boy because that reality in my home was not the reality I found in school. It took me a long time before, you know, I started to build inner resources to deal with how difficult we are. But I still do believe we should begin at home. I do still have a great deal of faith that all the aspects of openness and our ability to embrace each other exist. As I said, I work in the most rural area sometimes. The state of Kelantan is where I started 30 years ago. I find it one of the most accommodating, beautiful places, you know, for all that goes on in its politics. The ability of communities to embrace another with so much love and empathy that you almost immediately become families. That is a thing that is played out in my personal work. Every single time I travel the country and I get to know communities, and that is where my faith still rests, that somehow we are a community that is even bigger than the nation. Yeah, and I think that's our greatest resource.
On that note, thank you for your time today to discuss how we can improve the rich mosaic Malaysia is and should be. Joining me on the Breakfast Grill this morning was Datuk Dr. Shad Salim Faruqi, Tunku Abdul Rahman Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Malaya, and Edin Koo, author, frequent commentator on social, cultural issues, and of course, founder of Pusaka. I'm Wong Xiaoning, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.